This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. Today, I'm going to be speaking to my guest about adolescent sexual health issues. And my guest today is Dr. Anuradha Thyagarajan, a family medicine specialist. Now, family physicians, family medicine specialists like Dr. Anu get a unique glimpse into the lives of the families in our community. And this means that they get to observe the somewhat hidden challenges and needs of adolescents when it comes to sexual and reproductive health issues, which are still largely taboo in our society. So what exactly are the adolescent sexual health issues that are prevalent in our society? And what is the role of family physicians in talking to children and young people about their sexual health? So I'm going to be finding out more from Dr. Anu. How are you today, Dr. Anu?
Thank you. I'm all right. Thank you, Shoki, for giving me this opportunity to give an outlook on sexual problems that adolescents face these days, especially in Malaysia.
Yes, but you know, before we get into that, I guess it will be useful to sort of understand what exactly does it mean when we talk about sexual and reproductive health? What exactly does it cover?
Okay. Sexual health is actually more of an enhancement of life and personal relationship. It's not just merely counseling and care for procreation or sexually transmitted diseases. And the reproductive health, on the other hand, it is actually more of implying that people are responsible and have a good, satisfying, safe sex and their capability of having children. But also the freedom of deciding when and how to have children.
All right. And, you know, I guess coming from your observation, you know, maybe first you could give us an idea of, you know, within your clinic and your practice, what kinds of patients do you typically see? And leading on from that, what are the kinds of sexual and reproductive health issues that you see among them?
In my day-to-day cases in the clinic, I usually see teenage pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases among adolescents. Sadly, the leading death among girls, 15 to 19-year-old girls, due to complication of pregnancy and childbirth. Sadly, more than half of the abortions performed on these girls are actually unsafe abortion, and this leads to more long-term complications or death themselves. Complications on teenage mothers per se, usually it involves like problems such as eclampsia, which is fits during pregnancy. They have endometritis, which is infections in the uterus. They have systemic infections. And the child born to them also face complications such as preterm deliveries. They also have low birth weight, and they also have severe neonatal complications. And this is actually the tip of the iceberg if you see the problems that the teenage mothers have. They also have a big impact on their mental health and also their future role as in the socioeconomic part of the country.
What age do you typically see when it comes to the teenage pregnancies?
Usually, it still comes to around 13 to 19.
13 is terribly young. They would have just started their menses. They would have just gone into puberty.
Yeah, it's very sad to see these young girls going through a very big change in their body and their sexually, their sex hormones.
And you also mentioned STDs or sexually transmitted infections are the other issue you see. What are the most common STDs?
The most common STD that I see among adolescents are gonorrhea or syphilis.
And this would be among girls and boys?
Girls and boys, equally.
All right. You know, I'd like to explore a little bit more about how the adolescents are coming to your clinic, I think especially when it comes to the teenage pregnancy, at what point do they come to see you, Dr. Anu?
Some of them are brought in by parents. Some of them go through missed periods, and some of them have their body changes that they do not realize is actually teenage pregnancy itself. So they come to me in different presentations.
Mm. All right. And what's their state of mind when you see them?
They're actually, some of them, they know that they are probably going through a pregnancy change. But most of them are actually unaware of their pregnancy.
How is that possible, Dr. Anu? How could they be unaware? What do you think is lacking, I guess, in terms of their awareness of their own bodies and their own reproductive issues?
When it comes to being sexually active, some adolescents are not aware of the sexual activity all about. So they are not aware that, you know, how they can get pregnant, you know. So most of them have a lot of misconception about they are not capable of pregnancy. They have that, they even think that I can never be pregnant in first time doing it. They have like misconception like I'm too young to get pregnant, you know. So all these misconception that takes place in them and their knowledge which lacks in sexual education. That's also one of that plays a major important role in detecting late about their pregnancies.
I know we do have some surveys looking at use of contraception among young people. And I know we have national statistics also about at what age they become sexually active. But I'd like to hear from your actual experience seeing these young people. What do they tell you? At what age do they become sexually active? And, you know, like you said, if so many of them have these misconceptions about sexual intercourse, are any of them even practicing safe sex at all?
Well, it's sad to say that the National Morbidity and Mortality Survey in 2017 adolescents, the mean age of first sexual intercourse among adolescents, 14 years old. But if you look at their main source of information, their friends.
Mm-hmm.
And when they did the survey and they found that most of them, like for example, the male knows more about contraception than the female, especially when it comes to condom use. And the surprising thing is only the Form 4 and Form 5 students know more about contraception than the other forms. Form 1, Form 2, Form 3.
Mm-hmm.
But the mean age is actually 14 years old.
Which is
so Form 2.
Form 2, that's right.
Yeah, so you can see there is like a big gap of knowledge here when it comes to contraception.
All right. How would you describe what children are learning about sexual and reproductive health from school? And you say their main source of information is from their friends, right? What exactly are they learning?
Okay, if you look at the curriculum in the Ministry of Health, Ministry of Education, health education, what they call as pendidikan kesihatan, is actually part of their syllables. Okay, and if you look into the curriculum of the pendidikan kesihatan, it's actually quite complete. In standard one, they are being taught what is good touch, bad touch. In standard four, they are being taught what is the changes a girl go through, what is the changes the boy go through, and it readies them for prepubertal period. Okay, so hats off to the Ministry of Education because they have dedicated teachers who really they see the importance of sex education, integrating them in the pendidikan kesihatan. That's really good. I can see their initiation in educating the young ones about sex education as early as standard one. But unfortunately, educators who are given the task to deliver these syllables in school are not being trained. And they shy away from these topics, you know. So children, they learn about sexual health themselves or given homework, not knowing what they are doing actually. And parents, majority of them do not know the existence of these syllables in the education system. And most adolescents, they learn from their friends about puberty because they share information and then they see and experience the changes among themselves. So we can see that all these gaps that takes place, you know, contributing factors to awareness of sexual education in among adolescents.
When you say the educators are not trained and are not delivering the syllabus and the information that they should be, what exactly do you mean? Are they perhaps not even explaining to the students?
Because most of the time, the educators, they are not trained as pendidikan kesihatan teachers.
Mm.
They are actually other subject teachers who have to take up the pendidikan kesihatan as part of their teaching material. So this is one of the gaps that I see. You know, if they are trained well, they know how to deliver, they know how to talk to the adolescents, they know how to talk to the children, tell them, explain to them, probably the children will understand. And it will be a great information source for them compared to internet and media.
Yes, I wanted to touch on that because if kids are learning from their friends or they're sharing information among their friends, they're all getting it from the internet, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, you can't deny the facts. And in fact, a lot of studies have shown that media plays a major role in educating teenagers about sex. The problem is most of the information that they receive is pornography sites. So actually, adolescents, they're actually vulnerable to the flood of information, especially during the pre-puberty and also the puberty age, that period. So they are still undergoing developmental changes to understand about their gender roles, their sexual attitudes, their sexual behaviors. They are still undergoing all these developmental changes to know and recognize it. So when they go through all this flood of information, they can't actually critically analyze the information, you know, given to them, you know. And so they have a misconception of you know, what is sexual activity and then what is their gender roles and their attitude towards sex. So they have all this misconception because they cannot critically analyze it.
All right, let's go for a quick break. And when we come back, I want to find out more. What do you mean by sexual attitudes? Because on the one hand, you might think that knowing about sexual and reproductive health is just knowing about the physical changes and the physical way that sex works. But it would seem that there's so much more to it than that. So we'll come back and discuss more about that. I'm speaking to Dr. Anuradha Tyagarajan, family medicine specialist, about dealing with adolescent sexual health issues. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shaoik. I'm speaking to Dr. Anuradha Tyagarajan, family medicine specialist, and we are discussing sexual health and reproductive health issues among young people today. You know, coming from the perspective of Dr. Anu, through her family medicine practice, where she sees adolescents coming in, sometimes with their parents, often with their parents, of course. And she really sees the issues at the community level. Now, we know that sex is something that is so taboo in our society, and it's so difficult for us to talk about it openly, much less to take a proactive role in teaching our children about it. And I say children because it's not even about when they reach the teenage years. We already should start teaching our children about their bodies, how to be aware of the changes that their body is going through, all the different ways when it comes to touch and consent and things like that. All that starts at a very young age, isn't it, Dr. Anu? Now, you talked about gender roles and sexual attitudes and how a lot of our children, you know, when they are getting information from the internet, from the media, largely from pornography, they're grappling with gender roles and sexual attitudes. Now, can you explain a little bit more about that? What do you mean by sexual attitudes?
So actually, when we talk about educating the adolescents about sex, education, their reproductive health and all that, one, actually, because Malaysians, we are actually a very modest society. We don't talk about all these. I mean, parents, they know. In fact, studies have shown that parents know the importance of sex education. They are also aware that they are not given the same opportunity of knowing the knowledge and, about sex education and all that all. But when it comes to initiating conversations, especially when it comes to talking about sex education, there are changes in the body, there are gender roles, and talking about all that all, it's very difficult for them, okay? Because they are not brought up in that manner, okay? And then they're anxious about whether giving the right answers to the questions that pop up, you know? So when it comes to sexual roles and, you know, their sexual this one, it's like a taboo to them to talk about it. So when they are faced with question about why girls have to have this, why boys have to have this, you know, they are so scared. They are so scared to give the wrong information. So when they shy away from all this, the children do not get the correct information. And then when they see the information from the internet and all that, all they get the wrong information. And that's when they adapt according to what is norm in the social media.
Mm. You know, when children watch pornography, what are the wrong ideas that they are getting about sex?
They actually believe that real life sex is pornography. So that is the problem. And then pornography do not teach them about contraception. Pornography do not teach them about condom use. You know, so they don't know that this is important. What is safe sex? They don't know what is that. So when they get the information from these websites, from these pornography sites and all that, on, they get the information that this is all not important. Real life sex is going to be like this, you know, and that is their concept.
And apart from the physical act of sex, what are the other misconceptions or sort of misunderstood expectations that children and teenagers have about being in a relationship? From your experience, what do they know about interpersonal relationships? Do they really understand what's expected of them? What is expected of their partner? Do they understand respect? Do they understand consent?
Okay, most young girls in Malaysia, we are brought up being submissive. In fact, we can see patriarchy is actually quite common in Malaysia. Okay. In terms of, you can see discrimination among girls where there's food distribution, when it comes to household chores, when they are supposed to have educational opportunities, property inheritance, socializing with others. You can see that there are differences between boys and girls in Malaysia. Okay, so young girls, we tend to choose family over career. In fact, some ladies actually choose family over modern career path. Okay, so this is actually our expectations in as growing up in a Malaysian family. So when it comes to this growing up situation, environment, because they are brought up to be submissive, they actually become victims of domestic and sexual violence. In fact, they found out that workplace sexual harassment is actually common in places where patriarchy is still being observed. Okay, so these are the environment that we are brought in. From young, you see. So it affects us when as we grow older.
Mm. Okay. Do you think that at the adolescent age, when they're starting to explore relationships and social interactions and their own emotions as well, is that when there should be a balancing of these kinds of gender norms?
See, when it comes to gender norms, people like say that boys have to, they don't have to know about contraception. Only girls only have to know contraception. And then boys, they are brought up in such a way that, you know, they are not given the opportunities to be empowered on respecting about consent. Mm. Okay, consent is something that, you know, it is just not about sexual activities. It is about respecting one's boundaries, you know. Parents should bring up their boys in a manner where they learn about what is respecting others' properties, others' reputation, others' body parts, you know, that's important. Okay, so when boys, of course, when it comes to when they go into adolescence, they become a part of a group of boys, and then they have to go against the leaders, and that's when consent become very tricky, you see. So parents have to empower that boys, they cannot be like a chump, where, you know, they have to know what is right and what is wrong, okay? And we have to teach boys what is the power of no, okay? And respect it. Actually, if you look at boys, they're actually very vulnerable emotionally, okay? And they always want to look out for external validation from others, okay? And so parents and teachers have to teach them in a proper manner, okay? And the shame approach that usually boys get from parents and teachers, that's not the correct way of imparting knowledge to them.
What do you mean by the shame approach?
Shame approach, that means putting down them emotionally, telling with abusive words, or, you know, shaming them in front of public. You know, parents and teachers have this thinking that, you know, oh, this is how we are brought up, so they are also should be brought up this way. But boys are emotionally vulnerable. You cannot talk to them like that. You know, you have to tell them in a proper manner, empowering them from young.
You know, Dr. Anu, when you see the young girls coming into your clinic, when they get pregnant, you said between the ages of 13 and 19, are you seeing the boys as well? What is the boys' side of the story when it comes to teenage pregnancy?
Yeah, so usually when I see the girls. Of course, as a doctor, we are bound to our oath, and confidentiality is very important to us. So we always take like verbal confidentiality consent with the adolescents, and usually we will ask them when we breach the confidentiality, when it comes to harming to them or harming to others by them. And the adolescents, they understand about all this. Okay, so but when it comes to teenage pregnancies, I do have to agree that as a doctor in Malaysia, we abide to the Child Act Law. And the Child Act Law says that those adolescents who are sexually affected or they are involved sexually before the age of 16, it's our responsibility to admit them for legal actions, okay? Even though it is consensual sex. So most of the boys do not understand this, and they are affected because of this, you know? They think that it's consensual sex. But actually, when it comes to law, it's called as statutory rape. Okay, so it's sad that because they do not understand all this, and then the boys going through all this, called up by the police, and, you know, it affects them emotionally because they do not understand all this. Nobody told them. Nobody gave them that knowledge.
And by experimenting and by exploring in this way, they've ended up doing something that's illegal in the eyes of the law.
Yes. And it's sad because, I mean, all of us gone through adolescent age. All of us know that we all love to explore. We all love to experiment things. Okay. But they don't know what their boundaries. They don't know what is correct and what is wrong because they were not given that knowledge.
If it comes back to education and, you know, imparting this kind of information, even though we have Pendidikan Kesehatan that has a syllabus about physical, sexual health, you know, it does seem like it's still inadequate when it comes to issues regarding sexual attitudes and behaviours and responsibilities. Would you say that?
If we get everyone to be involved, I think we can do a better job in educating these young ones. It has to be everybody, from parents to teachers. Everyone has to be involved in this. Then we can see the results. In fact, even as doctors, when we see the adolescents, we do such thing as what we call as HAITS assessment. So when we assess the child, we find that the child is sexually active. It's our duty to tell them about what is safe sex. And then we have to educate them about it as part of the opportunistic health promotion.
So meaning as soon as you see that opportunity, you know, when they are in your clinic, you have that conversation with them.
Yeah. Yes.
How do their parents take it?
Okay. As I say, we are actually a very modest society. We're actually bound to the religion and cultural norms. Most of the time when parents come to my clinic for their child's reproductive health issues, they're actually worried. Parents are actually worried. Okay. So when we break the news, especially when it comes to teenage pregnancy or sexually transmitted infections, some parents are actually shocked. Some parents are angry. Some parents are in denial. You know, we let them ventilate, but not in front of the adolescents. Okay. So we let them ventilate, we counsel them, we talk to them, we tell them how to be supportive towards the adolescent and not pushing them away. And that causes more confusion to the adolescent, more neglect emotionally to them.
And if we were to take a few steps back where you said parents, we don't even know how to start having these conversations with our children. We don't know how to touch on these kinds of so-called sensitive topics. What can parents do? You know, where can they go to find support or help to know how to have these discussions with their kids?
Well, when they can actually use the Pendidikan Kesehatan book. They actually have all the they're very age appropriate. So it's like 7 years old, you're supposed to know this. So they can actually talk about it. You know, they can use that as their guidance. You know, sometimes if they go to standard four, that's when the prepubertal changes will take place. So parents can actually talk about, okay, this is what's going to happen to you. Okay. You know, so it's already there. So you can use that as a guidance. And it would help them to actually come out of the anxiety of talking about it.
And you know, considering that children are actually going through puberty at younger ages now, right, Dr. Anu, is it worthwhile for parents to bring their kids to a family physician or family health medicine specialist like yourself, even if there are no health problems, so to speak? Just as a way to introduce their children to the idea of taking care of themselves, taking care of their sexual and reproductive health, even before problems occur.
Okay, so because as family medicine specialists, we are actually a community doctor. We are just like a doctor serving to the community itself. So we are also part of health promotion and health prevention. So they can bring them to us as, you know, not just for the sake of telling about sexual reproductive health, but when they are sick, like for example, they come for other ailments and all that, all then probably they can tell doctor, you want to talk about, you know, sex and reproductive health to them and all that. All. So probably we can talk about it. You know, we can tell them what is correct, what is good touch, what is bad touch. You're supposed to respect your body. Teaching young girls about what is consent, what is when you say yes, it means yes. When you say no, it's definitely no. Teaching boys about consent, you know, telling them to respect others, respect the girls, how to respect and all that. Yes, we can help. But as I say, if we bring them just for that health promotion, just like that, they might not be able to accept. But bringing them as part of something else, and so we talk about it casually, it's going to be more easier. And then when we see them again, it's going to be even easier.
Do you find that young people perhaps are more willing to open up to you than to their own parents?
Because as doctors, we talk about confidentiality to them. So they know that when we are talking about confidentiality, in fact, before the conversation starts itself, we tell them, okay, this is confidential and we will not talk about it outside this room unless there's harm to you or harm to others by you. Then and they understand, and they know that, okay, if I tell the doctor this, it's going to be in this room. And when there's some problems that arise and I see that there is a harm to them or harm to others, and then I will talk to them. I say, okay, this is the part where I told you that confidentiality has to be breached. And they understand because they know that from the start of the conversation itself, it was already spelled out.
Mm.
And so they're open about the whole matter.
You know, do you find, Dr. Anu, is there an issue where those in the medical fraternity find it difficult to have these conversations, perhaps of their own cultural or personal values that may even interfere with their ability to be impartial when it comes to educating young people about sex?
As doctors, we can't let our personal views or religion affect our clinical judgment. If at all we find, be it a teenage pregnancy in front of us, or is it a homosexual adolescent, you know, in any way, if we find that we can't handle this, we will refer to another practitioner who can help them, you know. Because if we are clouded by personal values and religion, then our clinical judgment is not going to be correct. And when we advise the adolescent in front of us, we are not going to be, we're probably going to impose our values to them, you know. And probably then the adolescent might not be able to accept. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they, when they don't accept, we might lose them.
Do teenagers need parental consent in order to come and see you, whether it's for advice or even procedures?
Okay. Yes, when it comes to consultations, they have to have their parents along. Anyone who's less than 18 years old, and this is because the Child Act laws say so, that anyone who is less than 18 years old, they need to have the parents' consent. In fact, even some, we have teenage mothers who come and see us without their parents. Some of them, because they're actually from a broken family, their parents are not with them, and they can't come with the parents. So what we do is we will say, okay, never mind. We just have to inform your parents that, you know, they're aware of your situation and all that all. And the parents, if they sign that they agree, they don't have to come for the next subsequent visits for teenage pregnancy mothers. But as the first visit, they've already consented that they are agreeable to all the medical advisors, procedures and all that all. And so we can just continue.
I see.
So that is a consent that we take before we start our follow-ups with the teenage mothers. Mm. So this also same goes to other problems in teenagers. We have to get parents' consent. But we do have situations where children, they don't come with parents because, you know, they don't, some of them are from broken family and parents cannot come and all that all. We sometimes ask our child protectors help. You know, a child protector will be supportive to us and then they will say, okay, you know, doctor, you need to help. Do this. But in terms of emergencies, we don't usually wait for somebody to come and give consent. We will just act accordingly.
Mm. I'm also thinking there must be quite a number of teenagers who feel like they can't tell their parents what has happened out of fear or shame, perhaps.
Yeah. So usually these teenagers, when they come to us, if they come alone, and if something which is not, it's harm to them or it's harm to others, we don't disclose it to the parents. But the parents will have to know that they come for the appointment. That is the only thing. But we don't have to disclose it to the parents.
All right. So for instance, if a teenager has come to you, perhaps with an STD, so you're getting consent from the parents that the teenager is seeking your medical advice and treatment, but you don't have to disclose that their child came because of an STD. Is that right?
But when it comes to STD, I have to start treatment.
And so, that requires parents.
Yes,
I see.
Yes. Right. So, but usually parents, when it comes to the child's health, they are concerned. So if we talk to them properly and we counsel them, they are more acceptable. Although the child will say, no, my parents are very conservative, they are, cannot accept and all that all. If we talk to them, we let them ventilate and all that all, they are more acceptable. In fact, if you look at this, parents being very, very against, especially when it comes to teenage pregnancies, you know, they're against the child because they're pregnant suddenly. So this is where agencies have to work to to support the affected adolescent. You see, if agencies like, for example, the health clinics, the doctors and paramedics from the hospitals, the social worker, the police department, or in fact, the legal aid workers, okay, if they are being judgmental towards the adolescent, parents are going to feel the same way. They are going to be judgmental towards the child. Okay, but if these agencies, they work with the same concept of, I want to help the affected adolescent. I want to support the adolescent. Okay, if all of us work together in this same manner, the parents are going to mirror the same treatment towards the child. Okay, of course, being in a society with religious and cultural norms, it's not going to be easy for parents to accept, and they are very bitter about the whole matter. But if we provide that environment which is supportive towards parents and adolescents, it will be easier for them, you know. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I'm saying that agencies and parents, we have to work together in supporting the adolescent. Mm. It's not the child's fault in any ways.
And there's no place for shame, is there? There's no place for shame or blame.
Yeah. The shaming and the blaming is because they say, oh, you're dishonoring the family. You're shameful for the family. All this, it's not going to help the child. In fact, the adolescent is going to be emotionally more affected, you know, and then they will retaliate. And then, you know, you will get a bigger problems later on. But if we provide an environment which is very supportive from the start, probably the child will be, you know, better in the same sense of emotional support. And, you know, the child will be able to accept the problems that arise and all that on.
Okay. Do you have a final message today, Dr. Anu?
For me, adolescence, a very critical age where people, because we were in the society where, you know, we find that, they are already young adults, you know, they should act like an adult. You know, but it's a misconception. Adolescents are actually children with still developmental changes in them. Okay, we have to respect that. We have to see them as young adults who are still learning about themselves, who are still learning about the changes that's happening to them. They are still exploring who they are. They are still exploring whether they're going to be acceptable in the society. You know, and it takes time for them to be actually going through that phase. You know, in fact, we say that the brain actually matures fully only after 21, 22. Mm. So you see, when it takes that long for them to mature, so it also takes that long for them to understand, you know. So we have to be there to support and create an environment that is healthy for them.
And like you said, everyone plays a role, not just parents, not just teachers, but everyone working together, including with doctors.
Yes. As I say, all agencies have to work together. Everyone has to have the same concept of helping the adolescent, not judging them, not blaming them, not telling that, oh, it is part of the Z generation or the Y generation, not just blaming it on the generation itself, but being there for them.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Anu. I've been speaking to Dr. Anuradha Tyagarajan, family medicine specialist, about dealing with adolescent sexual health issues. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.